So, you're looking for a laughing place, eh?
How do you do and a mighty pleasant greeting. Thank you for joining us for episode 14 of The Backside of Water, a podcast that delves into the rich history,
awesome stories,
and fascinating details of your favorite Disney attractions.
I'm Alex Stewart.
And I'm Harrison Ownby.
We're proud to present to you our most zippity-doo-dah episode yet, folks. That's right, we're going to be talking about Splash Mountain.
Exactly right. This episode is dedicated to covering the wettest and wackiest attraction on this side of the rivers of America. And we're here to help you find your personal laughing place. And just like old Teddy Barra used to say, you can't find your laughing place unless you know a little bit of its history.
So Harrison wrote that transition, folks, so be sure to mention that when you give this episode a sour one-star review on iTunes.
But terrible transitions.
I did kind of like it, though. So I love that you actually wrote the fact that we needed to write this sour one-star review on there. So it was kind of like a meta writing right there. So well done. But anyway, we've got some history to cover, and I suppose there's no better time to start into it than right now. Disneyland had been open for more than two decades, and the west side of the park was a thriving wonderland of jungles, riverboats, pirates, and grim-grinning ghosts. Folks loved zigging through New Orleans Square and the Haunted Mansion, but very, very few guests were zagging their way back to the oft-forgotten Bear Country to pay a visit to the hard-working country bears and their jamboree. To be honest, Bear Country was a shell of a place.
A honey of a place? No.
No.
A shell of a place.
A shell. It was an empty hive.
Sad.
Since no one was returning to watch the Country Bear Jamboree, the area had a vacant, unused feel to it, very much unlike the rest of the park. Imagineers saw the far west side of the park was yet again falling victim to low guest numbers. They knew they had to do this. I got so excited because I knew they had to do something about it and fast, but I didn't know what they were going to do.
Stay tuned, folks, because we have the answers right here. Right after these messages from our sponsors. Just kidding, sponsors. So Imagineers wanted to do something in that area that hadn't been done in a Disney park before, but they weren't quite sure what they wanted to add. So they turned to the guests and started asking the guests what they might want. And come to find out, an overwhelming amount of people started asking for a log flume attraction.
Now, Harry, it might be good to explain what a log flume is to those who may not know.
Sure, I have an extensive history and experience with logs. That's what I said in my last job interview. It didn't go well. A log flume is essentially a log ride, or a ride where guests ride through a narrow waterway in a log. This process resembled how lumberjacks would send logs from the place where they cut the trees down to the place where the logs were turned into the loggy things that we all know and love.
I'm still just stuck on an extensive experience with logs.
Yeah.
There's so many different things you could read into that, but the most family-friendly is talking about, like, logging your hours somewhere.
Or Lincoln logs.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. Or Yule logs.
Oh, isn't there, like, a... Never mind. Some joke about Lincoln logs in the sandbox. Don't play with them. Or some rule.
I always build houses with those.
Because those are cat poops, right?
Oh, what?
Oh, no, Al. Your houses were all cat poops. What a terrible thing to learn.
You know what they say about throwing rocks at poop houses?
No, I don't.
I don't either. Help me. Here in Denver, we had an amusement park called Elitch Gardens that had a long ride.
A long log ride.
It had a long log ride like this. Where you would ride your log through what looked to be lumberjacks working in an old sawmill. It was pretty awesome.
And of course, the log flume in Knott's Berry Farm was always busy. Actually, it was interesting that folks wanted a log flume attraction because Walt, since the first days of Disneyland, wanted to install one but simply never got the chance.
Now, it's important to remember that this whole log flume debate was going on around the late 70s. That's important because Walt had been gone for almost a decade by now, and that's why there was so much debate on the subject. You know, if Walt had been alive and there was an opportunity to install a log flume attraction, you can guarantee it would have been made like that.
pronto. But since Walt had kind of left the ship without a captain, so to speak, there was a lot of question about what would be successful and what wouldn't.
Finally, a guy named Dick Nunes, the head of park operations at that time, kept pressing the fact that Walt Disney had always wanted a log flume ride. And eventually, Imagineers caved and decided to explore the new idea for a log flume attraction.
Imagineering wanted to play with the idea of using bears as the stars of this log flume attraction, since it played into the theming of Bear Country. This ride concept placed this flume attraction at the far backside of Bear Country, away from where the more civilized bears were at the Jamboree. No, these bears that folks would witness on the flume would be the backwoods, outlaw-type bears, the kind that required a little discipline from the business end of a six-shooter. Man, just the thought of this attraction gets me all riled up. Al, how awesome would it be to be able to ride this just for once, ride one of these attractions that barely missed the cut?
Well, that would be super awesome, and I may actually have an idea that's going to excite you quite a bit.
I doubt it, but I'll...
Well, here, hold on. Follow me this way.
Okay. Whoa! What an amazing doorway! Hidden behind this antique bookshelf in your study the whole time?
Harry, there's a lot you don't know about me. Now watch your footing on these steps. Staircase is a little steep.
Wow, this is a really, really long staircase. Where exactly are we going?
Ah, here we are. Read this plaque, my good man.
The Imaginarium established in 1706 for the exploration of the unexplainable and weird? Al, is this for real?
Well, I can tell you I'm not a figment of your imagination.
Who the heck are you?
Harry, I'd like to introduce you to my good friend Dr. Julius Sneck, the lead scientist of the New Horizons team here in my Imaginarium.
You know, I remember you saying that you'd inherited a research team from your great-grandfather, but I didn't know they were working deep underground under your study.
Again, Harry, there's a ton that you don't know about me. Dr. Sneck, can you show us the Monsanto?
Right this way, gentlemen.
Al, is that what I think it is?
It is indeed.
The Monsanto Mighty Microscope.
I thought they got rid of that when they took out Adventure Through Inner Space.
They did, but the doctor here and his crew managed to salvage the nanogenerator capacitor and reconstruct it here in the lab.
Does it work?
Well, we have been waiting for this very moment to test it.
Gentlemen, can you wheel that model over? Okay, that's good. Harry, are you ready?
What are you talking about? Al, what's going on? Why do you have that miniature of what looks like an attraction designed by Imagineers in the 70s?
You see, Harry, this is a model of a Bear Country attraction we've just been talking about. It's on loan to us from the Disney archives. What we're going to do is we're going to shrink down and ride through the actual model created by the WED team back in the 1970s.
Al, don't play with me like this. My heart will be forever broken if you're pulling my chain right now.
Dude, this isn't a joke. Dr. Sneck, if you will.
Now, gentlemen, stand directly over the X on the floor. And...
Oh! It worked!
Dr. Sneck, the shrinking was a success.
That's wonderful. Please let me know if there's anything I can do for you fellows.
Where are we, Al?
Well, take a look over that signpost.
Welcome to the Moonshine Express. Moonshine Express? Hey, that's the name of the flume attraction they were thinking about making, isn't it?
It sure is, and bro, guess what? We get to ride it.
Oh, snap, let's do this.
Howdy, partners. Welcome to the Moonshine Express. As sheriff of Bear Country, it's my duty to keep the people of the town safe. But there be some bears up in that there holler that be a-cooking up some moonshine, and I need your expertise. I now officially deputize you into the Country Bear Service Department. I need you to load up in one of them yonder logs there, grab a six-shooter, and take care of them bootlegging grizzly bears.
Al, this might be the greatest moment of my entire life.
I know, dude. This is going to be awesome. Quick, jump into the log.
Dude, these rifles in the log flume remind me of Buzz Lightyear's Astro Blasters meets the shooting gallery.
That's actually a great way to explain them. According to my research, we're supposed to shoot at the targets placed on the moonshine stills around these show scenes.
Hey, this first show scene is hilarious. Look at that bear with his nose caught in the honey hive.
Oh, dude, there's a moonshine still. Shoot it.
Good shot, Al.
Thanks, man. Oh, now as we round this corner, it looks like there's a bear who's whittling on his front porch. That's hilarious.
With us still located right next to him. Shoot it.
Oh, good one, Harry.
Looks like we may have some rapids up ahead. Al, look at those bears on the shore. They've got rifles just like ours.
And they're aiming right for us.
They're shooting at us?
According to my research, this is exactly how Webb planned it. The bears start shooting back. It's apparently half the fun?
Yeah, if your idea of fun is getting an armful of buckshot.
Oh, dude, watch out. There's more up on that log ahead of us.
Al, I think we have more to worry about than that gang of moonshining bears.
How you mean?
We're heading directly toward a waterfall.
Hold on tight.
Al, it seems like there's no end to this waterfall.
Because there isn't an end.
What are you talking about?
Oh, dude, the model wasn't complete. After the falls, the Imagineers left a gaping hole in the model.
What?
We're currently racing to the floor of the laboratory.
So we're gonna die on impact?
Not if I have anything to say about it. Dr. Sneck, I need you to aim the enlarger ray at the gaping hole at the back of the model and hit enlarge on my mark.
Okay, somebody is in position.
Hold it. Hold it.
What are we waiting for?
Harry, if we enlarge too soon, we're going to destroy the model. We can't destroy that part of history. Now hold it. And now.
We made it.
Oh, and it was all thanks to you, Snack. Now there you are, boys, safe and sound, back in the recording booth, with warm toddies in hand. Can I get you anything else?
How about another ride on the Moonshine Express? Only this time, I'm not going to ride it with a churro in my pocket. Boy, oh boy.
My goodness, what a soggy churro.
Wow, Harry, what an adventure.
You can say that again, but Al, the Moonshine Express was so awesome. Why didn't they end up making it?
Well, I guess the Disney execs weren't sold on the idea of arming kids and putting them in the middle of a liquor war. I'm sure this is also the time in which they removed the guns from the Jungle Cruise as well.
Well, if you ask me, putting a kid on the front lines to shoot at a bunch of rum runners is exactly the kind of character-building opportunity that gave us the Greatest Generation.
I totally agree. So, at this point, the WED team was at square one again. Until one day, Disney legend Tony Baxter got stuck in traffic.
We really can't talk much about Disneyland without talking about Tony Baxter, who was Senior Vice President of Walt Disney Imagineering Creative Development. We talked about him a little bit in our New Orleans Square episode and our Indiana Jones episode, because he was the Imagineer who redesigned the queue for Pirates so the guests weren't blocking the entrance to Critter Country, and he also had a huge... He basically project-managed the entire Indiana Jones thing.
Yeah.
He's one of those fantastic stories of someone who lived the American dream, started out scooping ice cream on Main Street when he was 17, and eventually went on to become Senior VP of Imagineering. And we'll be covering more of his legacy as we delve further into attractions that came out after Walt passed away. There's definitely a mark where you can see attractions that came out after Walt. You can see a lot of Tony Baxter's thumbprint on him.
Oh, absolutely. You can, I mean, because there was a pretty big gap there, but... Yeah. You can actually tell almost exactly. It's kind of like the rings on a tree. You can tell when the tree started growing differently because of Tony Baxter's influence.
Mm-hmm. So in 1983, it was a hot, stuffy summer day, and Tony Baxter was stuck in one of Los Angeles's most infamous features, bumper-to-bumper traffic. And as the cars inched forward, Baxter began to connect the dots. The Moonshine Express concept wasn't working, although Baxter liked that it was a log flume attraction with a large drop at the end. He wanted to keep those two aspects of the ride, and coincidentally, there were a ton of audio animatronics that were about to be homeless because of the closing of an attraction called America Sings. So Baxter decided to repurpose the audio animatronics to America Sings in this new attraction and set everything to a catchy tune called Zippity-Doo-Dah. This theme was based on the 1946 Disney film Song of the South, which was a film notorious for its depiction of slavery.
For any Disney fan, Song of the South is kind of mythological in the fact that nobody really has a legal, Disney-sanctioned copy of this film in its entirety, since the Walt Disney Company hasn't released a full film for home viewing. But for those who simply want to see what all the hoopla is about with this movie, I will tell you the internet's full of pirated copies from various countries across the globe. Please note, everybody, that we don't condone anyone going out and illegally getting a copy of this film.
Yeah, and be careful not to give your computer a virus or pay a crime lord or anything. I have actually gone against our official advice on the podcast, and I watched it on a website that was just all gray background with the video, and it was all grainy. But I've seen Song of the South, and it's a historic film for a couple reasons. One was that James Baskett, who is the actor who played Uncle Remus and voiced Br'er Fox and Br'er Rabbit, was the first African-American actor to receive an Oscar from his for his performance as Uncle Remus. He was awarded it posthumously. And the other is that Song of the South was Walt Disney's first live-action drama. But all that aside, I guess the real question is, if this film is so controversial, why did they decide to frame an entire attraction around it?
Well, that's actually a great question. But we need to keep a few things in mind while understanding the decision of the company to use Song of the South. Firstly, the film wasn't always considered as controversial now. It wasn't as controversial as it is now. In fact, they actually released it five different times between 1946 and 1986.
Really?
Yeah, back before we had VHS and DVDs and holoviewers. Patent pending.
I'm really excited for that patent to pin. I'm waiting with bated breath.
They're like, put a pin in it. In the patent.
Oh, in the patent. That's how you pinned patents. Yeah. You put pins in them.
Yeah, pins. Nobody's used a pin. Okay. I'm sorry. I just got in a loop there.
We're your official information pipeline for patents in the United States,
by
the
way. How to Get Yourself a Patent by Earl and Lou. It's a new podcast.
You just stick a pin in it, and suddenly it's patented.
It patented. Peyton Manning. It's just turned into a sports patent podcast.
Oh.
I sometimes hate what we do.
I zero regrets here. Except for
the
big one.
Over here.
I've taken all of yours
and put them on myself. So the Disney company would release its older animated films into theaters again and again so younger audiences could experience them. And Song of the South was one of those films that was in this rotation.
That's crazy. I hear, though, that Ron Miller, the guy who was running the show at Disney during the late 70s and early 80s, pulled Song of the South from rotation because he believed it wasn't enough with the times.
That's absolutely correct. But at the same time, Song of the South's intellectual property was somewhat of a hot topic around Disney's Imagineering.
The characters were some of the most popular in the Disneyland parks, even though the films weren't circulating, and that got Tony Baxter thinking it was time to add those characters to his attraction. He created a story that focused on the beloved characters and their predicaments in Song of the South, but removed the context of the stories being told by a slave. He began calling this attraction the Zippity-Doo-Dah Run, after the Academy Award-winning song from the film.
Baxter also loved the idea because he could use the animatronics from another Disneyland attraction that was slowly on its way out, America Sings. Located where Interventions is now in Tomorrowland, America Sings was a review show where audio animatronic animals would sing songs from America's songbook.
We'll go more into detail about America Sings in our Interventions episode, but Tony Baxter saw this as the perfect opportunity to use those characters in his new attraction.
Baxter then started working out the fine details of this concept. He made sketches, models, the whole nine yards. But there were also a horde of other potential Disneyland attractions that were in queue to be created before his idea for a log flume would even be looked at. You're asking yourself, just like I am, I'm sure, how would he ever get this project pushed to the front of the line, so to speak?
So enter Michael Eisner. Let's set the scene for the arrival of this guy. Now, as much of a hard time as we give Michael Eisner, mainly because he hassled Pixar, and you just don't do that and stay in our good graces, he probably saved the Walt Disney Corporation from bankruptcy when he was brought on board in 1984 to replace Ron Miller, the son-in-law of Walt Disney. Eisner diversified Disney's portfolio and built an umbrella for the company by acquiring ABC, ESPN, and Miramax. If you think about those times, Disney in the late 70s and early 80s, there are, like, no classics to come out of that time. And I was reading about The Black Cauldron, which almost bankrupted the company.
Wow.
Anyway.
I mean, I think there could be an argument for when did The Fox and the Hound came out? Come out.
That came out in 82, I think.
Okay. Because I think that was more of a popular one. But even still, like, The Rescuers and all of those films were considered, I mean, for the...
Great Mouse Detective.
Yeah, they were relatively flops for what people started to expect out of Disney.
Yeah, and when you think about your Disney classics, you think about the things that Walt Disney did, and then you don't really think of The Great Mouse Detective, even though it's not a bad movie. Or The Rescue... Rescuers? Is that
yeah.
It? Yeah.
Yeah, and even things like The Aristocats. There was a weird period of Disney films, somewhat after a lot of people say 101 Dalmatians, even though that was when Walt was still alive and working with the company. But that's for our other podcast called Talk Disney Animation That You Only Know Half of the History About with Alex and Harrison.
Yeah, talk loosely about something you know a little bit about because you know IMDb.
It's going to be a real hit with the internet trolls.
Yeah. Really going to make a splash mountain in the animation community.
Good segue.
Thanks. So back to Splash Mountain. One day, Michael Eisner and his son were touring Disney Imagineering, and naturally, Imagineering had all kinds of models and concepts lying around. But one particular model caught his son's attention, and it was Splash Mountain. His son was so taken by this model that Eisner gave the engineers permission to build a full-scale version. This was especially noteworthy because this was Eisner's first time greenlighting an attraction. But it was still an attraction based on Song of the South. Disney needed to build a flagship attraction to build Bear Country back to life, but they didn't want to become mired in controversy. So they decided to test the water by re-releasing Song of the South in select theaters and gauge the feedback, which would never happen today. But
no.
Lo and behold, the film made $10 million and didn't generate any controversy. So this was in 1986, and since then, Disney has forbidden any theatrical re-release of the film. So Michael Eisner agreed to make Splash Mountain as long as the attraction didn't include Uncle Remus. And Imagineers began to build a mountain in Bear Country, just like that. As a side note, many of Uncle Remus's lines and sayings are in the queue to set the tone of the ride, but they're obviously not attributed to Uncle Remus.
Now, there actually is there's people out there who say that the Uncle Remus character was replaced by a little frog that you see
Brer Frog
throughout.
Yeah.
But
they knew that that building a huge mountain in Critter Country wouldn't be easy, firstly because of the issue of wood.
Wood? What? Sorry, that was for my Full House peeps out there.
I had no idea I had no idea what you're talking about. I thought you were being Stitch.
They are very similar voices. I was being what's his name? Ranger Joe. And what was the name? What was the name of Joey Gladstone's woodchuck? Oh my gosh, I can't even believe that I'm slipping this. Oh my Full House peeps, I'm sorry to let you down.
I didn't watch Full House as much as I pretend to on this podcast.
Diehard fan.
It's mainly to make Al happy.
Yeah. So what are you talking about with wood?
Al feels the light inside him dying a little bit when people don't watch the same TV shows as he
does.
You don't
love Gipler? You're not a fan of Gipler?
You don't love Saved by the Bell?
Do you even Full House, bro?
Full House at me, bro. That doesn't make any sense. So the WED team, or Disney Imagineering, while working on Pirates of the Caribbean and other indoor water rides, understood that wood rot caused a multitude of issues, so they began to question how Baxter planned to solve this problem that had plagued so many water-based Disney attractions.
Now, Baxter's team came up with a really concrete solution.
Oh boy, here we go. What was the solution?
Get ready. I've been planning this.
Just say it, man. Just say it.
I'm going to say
okay.
It.
Okay. All right.
The concrete solution they came up with was... Concrete.
I did not see that coming. I mean, it came out of nowhere. It came out of nowhere. Boom.
Left field. That's how I live my life.
Hit me like a ton of truth. Shotgun
blast
of truth, bro.
Hit you like a ton of concrete.
Yeah.
So they would make all of the quote-unquote wooden set pieces out of concrete, then paint and coat them to look like wood. It was an awesome fix that prevents this attraction from having to go down for major refurbishments on a regular basis, like many of the older water attractions do.
Now that they had the wood rot issue taken care of, they went to work building the steel structure. Now, keep in mind, the infrastructure of this mountain was pretty beefy. They needed to dig deep, not only to create a great base of support for the system, but also because they needed to create a trough over 20 feet deep to hold all the water for the attraction.
That's right, Splash Mountain is a closed water system, isn't it?
It sure is. Folks, for those who aren't sure what that means, a closed water system does not draw its water from the rivers of America like some of the other water systems of Disneyland, like those of the Jungle Cruise and Pirates of the Caribbean. Anyway, once they had the foundation in place, they began biggering and biggering.
Sorry, I had to put that in there because my son is obsessed with The Lorax.
I watched a little bit of that movie. I think he likes it because he can't understand it.
Yeah, he doesn't get the fact that the environment is being ruined. Instead, he sings along with the big evil corporate giant, and he's like, "How bad can I possibly be?"
When you said biggering, it sounds like bickering.
Oh,
but I bickering. Began bickering and bickering.
Bickering and bickering. The bickering is actually characterized by the sheer size of the paddle boat in the final scene of the attraction. This was really cool when I found this out, that the paddle boat is the largest moving prop that's ever been created by Disney.
That's crazy.
I know. And to house such a large prop and show scene, they actually created a room that was 35 feet tall, one of the largest showrooms in all of Disneyland. It was so large, in fact, that it forced the Imagineers to reroute the Disneyland Railroad to make way for this room.
So is that why the train passes through that room?
That's exactly why. The huge room was only one of the many huge areas created by this attraction. And in such a place like this, populating it with characters is also key because it's so large.
Yeah.
Imagineers went to work populating the attraction with 114 audio animatronics from America Sings. That's not including the brand new audio animatronics they created exclusively for the attraction. There's actually something cool and maybe not very well known, kind of a full circle story surrounding the America Sings character's transplant into Splash Mountain. Disney legend Mark Davis was actually, I don't know, can you hear Jack in the background? Because that cracks me up.
Yeah, but it's not the first time. And it's always assuring to know that, you know, if something ever happens to you, that there's little you growing up in the background.
He's keeping my legacy going by yelling, "Where's Tanner?"
He's my future co-host.
So Disney legend Mark Davis was actually the man responsible for many of the character designs in the film Song of the South. He was also the man responsible for the character designs for America Sings.
So his worlds collide on Splash Mountain.
Exactly. It's a fun little piece of Disney fun you can share with your other Disney nerd friends at Disney nerd cocktail parties that everybody has, right?
I've never been to one, but I would be a little scared.
I haven't either. I would just always assume that I wasn't cool enough for them.
Maybe they have, if you know any Disney nerd cocktail parties, invite us, please.
I think there's one at Bohemian Grove or something like that.
Really?
I heard.
Did Disneyland?
Isn't that where the Illuminati gets together?
Bohemian Grove? Bohemian Rhapsody?
I think that's it. They actually get together and just listen to old Queen records.
I see a little silhouette. If that's not a song all about Illuminati, I don't know what is.
Confirmed.
Check. So, another thing that makes these America Sings characters so much at home is the fact that the Splash Mountain is a musical mountain, and all the characters love to sing. And many of the voices...
Hey, look yonder, a musical mountain!
Hi-yo, mountain! So, there's a lot of voice actors that help this mountain be musical. You've got Thurl Ravenscroft of Tiki Room Haunted Mansion and Tony the Tiger fame. He was framed as Tony the Tiger and then became famous for it. His voice is on the attraction. Excuse me. Nick Stewart, the original voice of Br'er Bear, is the voice of Br'er Bear in this attraction.
Where were you going with that?
I feel like my inflections made it sound like there was something more to it, but there's not. It was the original voice of Br'er Bear, and he's also the voice of Br'er Bear on the attraction. There it is.
There you go. Good work, bud.
Thanks.
Good work. So Jess Harnell is the voice of Br'er Rabbit, but you may know him better as the voice of Wacko on TV's The Animaniacs. He's also the voice of Woosin. He's also the voice of Wooten Bassett on one of my favorites, the children's radio show Adventures in Odyssey.
That's amazing, Al. Did you just do a little jig when you learned that fact?
Oh my gosh. Well, I actually had thought about it for many years before. I was like, man, Br'er Rabbit sounds exactly like Wooten.
Really?
And then when I saw that on there, I was like, I knew that was Wooten. That totally is.
Well, he also sings. He sings in Zippity-Doo-Dah. And
so, yes.
So, I mean, Jess Harnell is a really talented voice actor.
Yeah, he's like a powerhouse. He's all over the place. He's kind of like a Hal Smith or the guy who plays like all 49 voices on Futurama.
Oh, yeah. Or a Mel Blanc. He was kind of the first guy.
Yes. A-dee-ba-dee-ba-dee-ba-da.
So you can also hear old Rufus the Sleeping Bear on the attraction, who was old holdover from Bear Country. He can be heard sawing logs inside Br'er Bear's place. And I suppose this is as good a time as any to talk about the music. Imagineers knew that this attraction needed a really strong musical foundation because it is a musical mountain, after all, as we established earlier. Originally, it was the Zippity-Doo-Dah Run. That was the name that they had planned for it. So Zippity-Doo-Dah was re-recorded by a choir of 75 people in the company's Burbank studios in 1987, and they made the song absolutely larger than life.
Now, this attraction was going with the flow quite well, but during the test and adjust season, Imagineers began seeing issues here and there. It began to seem like there were certain things that simply didn't even fit.
What do you mean, Al?
I mean, they simply literally didn't fit together. Some of the ride mechanics and pieces just weren't working, and they couldn't figure out why. Finally, they realized that during the planning phases, it was discovered that the whole attraction needed to be shrunk down by 10% to make it fit in the area it needed to go. So a nameless Imagineer did what anyone would do. He went to the copy machine, hit the 90% button, and reprinted the schematics.
Oh, no. Sounds like that wasn't the best choice.
Exactly. So he thought, well, it makes sense just to shrink everything 10%. And I mean, I'm not a math guy, so it seems like that would work out. But apparently, that made everything kind of fall apart, caused quite a few issues, and ultimately ended up delaying the opening of the attraction by quite a few months. They got the scaling issues taken care of, but they hit another roadblock, or should I say river block.
Or they hit another log in the river, as the old folk saying goes. They found
that's the one.
Yeah, hit a log in the river, Cletus, you go on ahead. They found that the tests being run on the 52.5-foot drop were not looking pretty. In fact, at one point, it is rumored that a maintenance man saw that they were performing tests and chose to ride the attraction, which is fantastic. That's just a classic story. He's like,
hey, there's a log going. I guess I'll get on it.
First, woo! Well, the drop was so severe that the man ended up breaking his leg from it.
It's quite a legacy he left.
I wrote that joke, so I'm sorry.
Get it, legacy.
Yeah, yep.
He just read the line.
He has a leg up on a legacy, in Splash Mountain. I don't know if I have any more leg puns.
I don't have any actually. This is the first time that I've been punless.
Well, thankfully, Imagineers were able to fix these issues. They weren't able to fix Al's lack of puns right now. But after a few delays and a soaring price tag of 75 million clams, Splash Mountain opened to throngs of guests on July 17th, 1989. On opening day, the line for the attraction stretched out the queue area around the Rivers of America and stopped around where the boat landing area and Mark Twain and sailing ship Columbia were.
That's nuts. And during those first days, the Disney executives rode the attraction for the first time, and they found themselves soaked. Not just soaked, but drenched completely. It was so bad that at one point, Tony Baxter rode Splash Mountain and got so soaked that he had to leave the park to change into dry clothes.
But they did maths, and they found that if they re-angled the drop by a mere 2 degrees, the splash issue was fixed. This caused an issue, though, with the splashy feel of the attraction for those standing on the bridge viewing. So Imagineers installed water cannons that splash out massive amounts of water for every 3 logs that go down Chicopin Falls.
Speaking of splashing, Michael Eisner originally wanted this attraction to be themed after the newest film that was being promoted by Disney, Splash, starring Tom Hanks and Daryl Hannah.
This is one of the reasons why we kind of roll our eyes about Michael Eisner, because this is a classic Michael Eisner idea.
Exactly, exactly. Cross-promote. Imagineers actually hated the idea. Yeah, they hated it for a ton of good reasons.
Yeah.
But in order to keep the new boss happy, they settled on a compromise and changed the name of the attraction from Zippity-Doo-Dah Run to Splash Mountain.
That story is so ridiculous, it almost sounds made up. Have you seen Splash, by the way, the movie?
It's a great movie. My parents almost named me after the main character, Madison.
So you were almost named after a Tom Hanks character. Wow.
Well, no. If I was a girl, sorry, I would have been named after the mermaid in there, Madison.
Oh, man. It's one of those names that can be a boy's name or a girl's name. The success of Splash Mountain actually encouraged Imagineers to open versions of the attraction at both Walt Disney World and Tokyo Disney. It's crazy because these two attractions opened within a day of one another. Talk about splash fever.
Splash fever! No, sorry.
Happens.
I was thinking about like Saturday Night Splash Fever.
It needs to be a song.
I agree. Let's get
into the hot summer jam of 2027 or whatever.
Let's get into the studio for that.
Yeah.
Splash Mountain is unique in that it hasn't had any major refurbishments or overhauls since its 1989 opening.
It is absolutely timeless. And there's so much to see and experience each time you ride it. It's such a robust attraction that it revitalized Critter Country. So folks, next time life drops you into a briar patch, know that your laughing place isn't far away. And while there are some scheming critters out there, sure as you're born, you'll find out that you're even cleverer than they are. And when you outsmart them and float out of that rough old briar patch with a sun on your face and a smile you can't hold back, know that the feeling is the truth, it's actual, and everything is indeed satisfactual. Thanks to the traffic jam that helped Tony Baxter come up with the concept, and to Michael Eisner, who took a risky chance and saved Critter Country. I never thought I would thank Michael Eisner in this podcast, but here we are. Also, I wanted to give a special thanks to Alex for writing this entire episode while I was paralyzed with existential dread. Fear and loathing, folks. I need to visit a Disney park here soon. You know the feeling? Anyway, if you like this episode, we're on the Webernet or the Nutter Fluffer or whatever it's called. Follow us on Instagram or Twitter for the occasional Disney update, tip, or just to hear us say, how do you do? And if you leave us an iTunes review, that would make our zippity-doo-dah day.
It would indeed, folks. So as you exit, be sure to watch your step and watch your head.
And if you miss your step and you hit your head, please, watch your language. Bye.
Bye.